Penguin Audio presents The Breathing Method by Stephen King. Read by Frank Muller.
1. The Club. I dressed a bit more speedily than normal on that snowy, windy, bitter night, I admit. It was December 23rd, 1977, and I suspect that there were other members of the club who did the same. Taxis are notoriously hard to come by in New York on stormy nights, so I called for a radio cab. I did this at 5:30 for an 8 o'clock pickup. My wife raised an eyebrow, but said nothing. I was under the canopy of the apartment building on East 58th Street, where Helen and I had lived since 1946, by 7:45. And when the taxi was 5 minutes late, I found myself pacing up and down impatiently. The taxi arrived at 8:10, and I got in, too glad to be out of the wind to be as angry with the driver as he probably deserved. That wind, part of a cold front that had swept down from Canada the day before, meant business. It whistled and whined around the cab's window, occasionally drowning out the salsa on the driver's radio and rocking the big checker on its springs. Many of the stores were open, but the sidewalks were nearly bare of last-minute shoppers. Those that were abroad looked uncomfortable or actually pained. It had been flurrying on and off all day, and now the snow began again, coming first in thin membranes, then twisting into cyclone shapes ahead of us in the street. Coming home that night, I would think of the combination of snow, a taxi, and New York City with considerably greater unease. But I did not, of course, know that then. At the corner of 2nd and 40th, a large tinsel Christmas bell went floating through the intersection like his spirit. "Bad night," the cabbie said. "They'll have an extra 2 dozen in the morgue tomorrow. Wino popsicles, plus a few bag lady popsicles." "I suppose," the cabbie ruminated. "Well, good riddance," he said finally. "Less welfare, right?" "Your Christmas spirit," I said, "is stunning in its width and depth." The cabbie ruminated. "You one of those bleeding heart liberals?" he asked finally. "I refuse to answer on the grounds that my answer might tend to incriminate me," I said. The cabbie gave a "why do I always get the Weisenheimers" snort, but he shut up. He let me out at 2nd and 35th, and I walked halfway down the block to the club, bent over against the whistling wind, holding my hat on my head with one gloved hand. In almost no time at all, the life force seemed to have been driven deep into my body, a flickering blue flame about the size of the pilot light in a gas oven. At 73, a man feels the cold quicker and deeper. That man should be home, in front of a fireplace, or at least in front of an electric heater. At 73, hot blood isn't even really a memory. It's more of an academic report. The latest flurry was letting up, but snow as dry as sand still beat into my face. I was glad to see that the steps leading up to the door of 249B had been sanded. That was Stevens' work, of course. Stevens knew the base alchemy of old age well enough. Not lead into gold, but bones into glass. When I think about such things, I believe that God probably thinks a great deal like Groucho Marx. Then Stevens was there holding the door open, and a moment later I was inside. Down the mahogany-paneled hallway, through double doors standing three-quarters of the way open on their recessed tracks, into the library, come reading room, come bar. It was a dark room in which occasional pools of light gleamed, reading lamps. A richer, more textured light glowed across the oak parquet floor, and I could hear the steady snap of birch logs in the huge fireplace. The heat radiated all the way across the room. Surely there is no welcome for a man or a woman that can equal a fire on the hearth. A paper rustled, dry, slightly impatient. That would be Johansson with his Wall Street Journal. After 10 years, it was possible to recognize his presence simply by the way he read his stocks. Amusing, and in a quiet way, amazing. Stevens helped me off with my overcoat, murmuring that it was a dirty night. WCBS was now forecasting heavy snow before morning. I agreed that it was indeed a dirty night and looked back into that big high-ceilinged room again. A dirty night, a roaring fire, and a ghost story. Did I say that at 73 hot blood is a thing of the past? Perhaps so. But I felt something warm in my chest at the thought, something that hadn't been caused by the fire or Stephen's reliable, dignified welcome. I think it was because it was McCarran's turn to tell the tale. I had been coming to the brownstone, which stands at 249B East 35th Street, for 10 years, coming at intervals that were almost, but not quite, regular. In my own mind, I think of it as a gentleman's club, that amusing, pre-glorious Steinem antiquity. But even now I am not sure that's what it really is, or how it came to be in the first place. On the night Emlyn McCarran told his story, the story of the breathing method, there were perhaps 13 club members in all, although only 6 of us had come out on that howling bitter night. I can remember years when there might have been as few as 8 full-time members, and others when there were at least 20, and perhaps more. I suppose Stevens might know how it all came to be. One thing I am sure of is that Stevens has been there from the first, no matter how long that may be, and I believe Stevens to be older than he looks, much, much older. He has a faint Brooklyn accent. But in spite of that, he is as brutally correct and as cuttingly punctilious as a third-generation English butler. His reserve is part of his often maddening charm, and Stevens's small smile is a locked and latched door. I have never seen any club records, if he keeps them. I have never gotten a receipt of dues. There are no dues. I have never been called by the club secretary. There is no secretary. And at 249B East 35th, there are no phones. There is no box of white marbles and black balls, and the club, if it is a club, has never had a name. I first came to the club, as I must continue to call it, as a guest of George Waterhouse. Waterhouse headed the law firm for which I had worked since 1951. My progress upward in the firm, one of New York's 3 biggest, had been steady but extremely slow. I was a slogger, a mule for work, something of a center puncher. But I had no real flair or genius. I had seen men who had begun at the same time I had, promoted in giant steps, while I only continued to pace, and I saw it with no real surprise. Waterhouse and I had exchanged pleasantries, attended the obligatory dinner put on by the firm each October, and had little more congress until one fall in the 1960s when he dropped by my office one day in early November. This in itself was unusual enough, and it had me thinking black thoughts, dismissal, that were counterbalanced by giddy ones, an unexpected promotion. It was a puzzling visit. Waterhouse leaned in the doorway, his Phi Beta Kappa key gleaming mellowly on his vest, and talked in amiable generalities. None of what he said seemed to have any real substance or importance. I kept expecting him to finish the pleasantries and get down to cases. Now about this case, he briefed, or we've been asked to research the mayor's appointment of Salkowitz, too, but it seemed there were no cases. He glanced at his watch, said he had enjoyed our talk and that he had to be going. I was still blinking, bewildered, when he turned back and said casually, "There's a place where I go most Thursday nights, a sort of club. Old duffers mostly, but some of them are good company. They keep a really excellent cellar, if you've a palate. Every now and then, someone tells a good story as well. Why not come down some night, David, as my guest?" I stammered some reply. Even now, I'm not sure what it was. I was bewildered by the offer. It had a spur-of-the-moment sound, but there was nothing spur-of-the-moment about his eyes. Blue Anglo-Saxon ice under the bushy white whorls of his eyebrows, and if I don't remember exactly how I replied, it was because I felt suddenly sure that this offer, vague and puzzling as it was, had been exactly the specific I had kept expecting him to get down to. Ellen's reaction that evening was one of amused exasperation. I had been with Waterhouse, Carden, Lawton, Fraser, and Effingham for something like 15 years, and it was clear enough that I could not expect to rise much above the mid-level position I now held. It was her idea that this was the firm's cost-efficient substitute for a gold watch. "Old men telling war stories and playing poker," she said. A night of that and you're supposed to be happy in the reading library until they pension you off, I suppose. Oh, I put 2 becks on ice for you, and she kissed me warmly. I suppose she had seen something on my face. God knows she's good at reading me after all the years we've spent together. Nothing happened over a course of weeks. When my mind turned to Waterhouse's odd offer, certainly odd, coming from a man with whom I met less than a dozen times a year and whom I only saw socially at perhaps 3 parties a year, including the company party in October, I suppose that I had been mistaken about the expression in his eyes that he really had made the offer casually and had forgotten it, or regretted it. Ouch. And then he approached me one late afternoon, a man of nearly 70, who was still broad-shouldered and athletic-looking. I was shrugging on my topcoat with my briefcase between my feet. He said, "If you'd still like to have a drink at the club, why not come tonight?" Well, I... Good! He slapped a slip of paper into my hand. Here's the address. He was waiting for me at the foot of the steps that evening, and Stevens held the door for us. The wine was as excellent as Waterhouse had promised. He made no attempt whatsoever to introduce me around. I took that for snobbery, but later recanted the idea. But 2 or 3 of them introduced themselves to me. One of those who did so was Emlyn McCarran, even then in his late 60s. He held out his hand, and I clasped it briefly. His skin was dry, leathery, tough, almost turtle-like. He asked me if I played bridge. I said I did not. "God-damned good thing," he said. "That god-damned game has done more in this century to kill intelligent after-dinner conversation than anything else I can think of." And with that pronouncement, he walked away into the murk of the library, where shelves of books went up apparently to infinity. I looked around for Waterhouse, but he had disappeared. Feeling a little uncomfortable and a lot out of place, I wandered over to the fireplace. It was, as I believe I have already mentioned, a huge thing. It seemed particularly huge in New York, where apartment dwellers such as myself have trouble imagining such a benevolence big enough to do anything more than popcorn or toast bread. The fireplace at 249B East 35th was big enough to broil an ox whole. There was no mantle. Instead, a brawny stone arch curved over it. This arch was broken in the center by a keystone which jutted out slightly. It was just on the level of my eyes, and although the light was dim, I could read the legend engraved on that stone with no trouble. "It is the tale, not he who tells it." "Here you go, David," Waterhouse said from my elbow, and I jumped. He hadn't deserted me after all, and only trudged off into some uncharted locale to bring back drinks. "Scotch and soda's yours, isn't it?" "Yes, thank you, Mr. Waterhouse." "George," he said. "Here it's just George." "George, then," I said, although it seemed slightly mad to be using his first name. "What is all of..." "Cheers," he said. We drank. Stevens tends the bar. He makes fine drinks. He likes to say it's a small but vital skill. The scotch took the edge off my feelings of disorientation and awkwardness. The edge, but the feelings themselves remained. I had spent nearly half an hour gazing into my closet and wondering what to wear. I had finally settled on dark brown slacks and a rough tweed jacket that almost matched them, hoping I would not be wandering into a group of men either turned out in tuxedos or wearing blue jeans and L.L. Bean's lumberjack shirts. It seemed that I hadn't gone too far wrong on the matter of dress, anyway. A new place and a new situation make one crucially aware of every social act, no matter how small, and at that moment, drink in hand and the obligatory small toast made, I wanted very much to be sure that I hadn't overlooked any of the amenities. "Is there a guest book I ought to sign?" I asked, something like that. He looked mildly surprised. "Oh, we don't have anything like that," he said. "At least, I don't think we do." He glanced around the dim, quiet room. Johansson rattled his Wall Street Journal. I saw Stevens pass in a doorway at the far end of the room, ghostly in his white mess jacket. George put his drink on an end table and tossed a fresh log onto the fire. Sparks corkscrewed up the black throat of the chimney. "What does that mean?" I asked, pointing to the inscription on the keystone. "Any idea?" Waterhouse read it carefully, as if for the first time. "It is the tale, not he who tells it." "I suppose I have an idea," he said. "You may, too, if you should come back." "Yes, I should say you may have an idea or two. in time. Enjoy yourself, David. He walked away. And although it may seem odd having been left to sink or swim in such an unfamiliar situation, I did enjoy myself. For one thing, I have always loved books, and there was a trove of interesting ones to examine here. I walked slowly along the shelves, examining the spines as best I could in the faint light, pulling one out now and then and pausing once to look out a narrow window at the Second Avenue intersection up the street. I stood there and watched through the frost-rimed glass as the traffic light at the intersection cycled from red to green to amber and back to red again, and quite suddenly I felt the queerest and yet very welcome sense of peace come to me. It did not flood in. Instead, it seemed almost to steal in. Oh, yes, I can hear you saying, that makes great sense. Watching a stop-and-go light gives everyone a sense of peace. All right, it made no sense, I grant you that, but the feeling was there just the same. It made me think for the first time in years of the winter nights in the Wisconsin farmhouse where I grew up, lying in bed in a drafty upstairs room and marking the contrast between the whistle of the January wind outside, drifting snow as dry as sand along miles of snow fence, and the warmth my body created under the two quilts. There were some law books, but they were pretty damn strange. 20 cases of dismemberment and their outcomes under British law is one title I remember. Pet Cases was another. I opened that one, and sure enough, it was a scholarly legal tome dealing with the law's treatment, American law this time, of cases which bore in some important respect upon pets. Everything from house cats that had inherited great sums of money to an ocelot that had broken its chain and seriously injured a postman. There was a set of Dickens, a set of Defoe, a nearly endless set of Trollope. And there was also a set of novels, 11 of them, by a man named Edward Gray Seville. They were bound in handsome green leather, and the name of the firm gold-stamped on the spine was Stedham and Son. I had never heard of Seville or of his publishers. The copyright date of the first Seville, These Were Our Brothers, was 1911. The date of the last, The Breakers, was 1935. Two shelves down from the set of Seville novels was a large folio volume which contained careful step-by-step plans for erector set enthusiasts. Next to it was another folio volume, which featured famous scenes from famous movies, each of these pictures filled one whole page, and opposite each, filling the facing pages, were free verse poems, either about the scenes with which they were paired or inspired by them. Not a very remarkable concept, but the poets who were represented were remarkable. Robert Frost, Marianne Moore, William Carlos Williams, Wallace Stevens, Louis Zukofsky, and Erica Jong, just to mention a few. Halfway through the book, I found a poem by Algernon Williams set next to that famous photograph of Marilyn Monroe standing on the subway grating and trying to hold her skirt down. The poem was titled The Toll, and it began, "The shape of the skirt is, we would say, the shape of a bell. The legs are the clapper." And some such more. Not a terrible poem, but certainly not Williams's best or anywhere near the top drawer. I felt I could hold such an opinion because I had read a good deal of Algernon Williams over the years. I could not, however, recall this poem about Marilyn Monroe, which it is. The poem announces it, even when divorced from the picture. At the end, Williams writes, "My legs clap my name, Marilyn Marbelle." I have looked for it since then and haven't been able to find it, which means nothing, of course. Poems are not like novels or legal opinions. They are more like blown leaves, and any omnibus volume entitled The Complete So-and-So must certainly be a lie. Poems have a way of getting lost under sofas. It is one of their charms and one of the reasons they endure. But at some point, Stevens came by with a second scotch. By then I had settled into a chair of my own with a volume of Ezra Pound. It was as fine as the first. As I sipped it, I saw two of those present, George Gregson and Harry Stein. Harry was 6 years dead on the night Evelyn McCarran told us the story of the breathing method. Leave the room by a peculiar door that could not have been more than 42 inches high. It was an Alice down the rabbit hole door, if there ever was one. They left it open, and shortly after their odd exit from the library, I heard the muted click of billiard balls. Stevens passed by and asked if I would like another scotch. I declined with real regret. He nodded, "Very good, sir." His face never changed, and yet I had an obscure feeling that I had somehow pleased him. Laughter startled me from my book some time later. Someone had thrown a packet of chemical powder into the fire and turned the flames momentarily parti-colored. I thought of my boyhood again, but not in any wistful, sloppily romantic, nostalgic way. I feel a great need to emphasize that, God knows why. I thought of times when I had done just such a thing as a kid, but the memory was a strong one, pleasant, untinged with regret. I saw that most of the others had drawn chairs up around the hearth in a semicircle. Stevens had produced a heaping, smoking platter of marvelous hot sausages. Harry Stein returned through the down-the-rabbit-hole door, introducing himself hurriedly but pleasantly to me. Gregson remained in the billiard room, practicing shots by the sound. After a moment's hesitation, I joined the others. A story was told, not a pleasant one. It was Norman Stett who told it, and while it is not my purpose to recount it here, perhaps you'll understand what I mean about its quality if I tell you that it was about a man who drowned in a telephone booth. When Stett, who is also dead now, finished, someone said, "You should have saved it for Christmas, Norman." There was laughter, which I, of course, did not understand, at least not then. Waterhouse himself spoke up then. "And such a Waterhouse I never would have dreamed of in 1,000 years of dreaming. A graduate of Yale, Phi Beta Kappa, silver-haired, three-piece suited, head of a law firm so large it was more enterprise than company, this Waterhouse told a story that had to do with a teacher who had gotten stuck in a privy. The privy stood behind the one-room schoolhouse in which she had taught, and the day she got her caboose jammed into one of the privy's two holes also happened to be the day the privy was scheduled to be taken away as Anniston County's contribution to the Life as It Was in New England exhibition being held at the Prudential Center in Boston. The teacher hadn't made a sound during all the time it took to load the privy onto the back of a flatbed truck and to spike it down. She was struck dumb with embarrassment and horror, Waterhouse said. And when the privy door blew off into the passing lane on Route 128 in Somerville during rush hour... But draw a curtain over that. And over any other stories which might have followed it, they are not my stories tonight. At some point, Stevens produced a bottle of brandy that was more than just good. It was damn near exquisite. It was passed around, and Johansson raised a toast. The toast, one might almost say. The tale, not he who tells it. We drank to that. Not long after, men began slipping away. It wasn't late, not yet midnight anyway, but I've noticed that when your 50s give way to your 60s, late begins coming earlier and earlier. I saw Waterhouse slipping his arms into the overcoat Stevens was holding open for him and decided that must be my cue. I thought it strange that Waterhouse would slip away without so much as a word to me, which certainly seemed to be what he was doing. If I had come back from shelving the pound book 40 seconds later, he would have been gone. But no stranger than most of the other things that had gone on that evening. I stepped out just behind him, and Waterhouse glanced around as if surprised to see me, and almost as if he had been startled out of a light doze. "Share a taxi?" he asked, as though we had just met by chance on this deserted, windy street. "Thank you," I said. I meant thanks for a great deal more than his offer to share a cab, and I believe that was unmistakable in my tone, but he nodded as if that were all I had meant. A taxi with its for-hire light lit was cruising slowly down the street. Fellows like George Waterhouse seemed to luck onto cabs even on those miserably cold or snowy New York nights when you would swear there isn't a cab to be had on the entire island of Manhattan. And he flagged it. Inside, safely warm, the taxi meter charting our journey in measured clicks, I told him how much I had enjoyed his story. I couldn't remember laughing so hard or so spontaneously since I was 18, I told him, which was not flattery, but only the simple truth. Oh, how kind of you to say. His voice was chillingly polite. I subsided, feeling a dull flush on my cheeks. One does not always need to hear a slam to know that the door has been closed. When the taxi drew up to the curb in front of my building, I thanked him again, and this time he showed a trifle more warmth. It was good of you to come on such short notice, he said. Come again if you like. Don't wait for an invitation. We don't stand much on ceremony at 249B. Thursdays are best for stories, but the club is there every night. Am I then to assume membership? The question was on my lips. I meant to ask it. It seemed necessary to ask it. I was only mulling it over, listening to it in my head, in my tiresome lawyer's way, to hear if I'd got the phrasing right. Perhaps that was a little too blunt when Waterhouse told the cabbie to drive on. The next moment the taxi was rolling on toward Park. I stood there on the sidewalk for a moment, the hem of my topcoat whipping around my shins, thinking, he knew I was going to ask that question. He knew it, and he purposely had the driver go on before I could. Then I told myself that was utterly absurd, paranoid even, and it was. But it was also true. I could scoff all I liked. None of the scoffing changed that essential certainty. I walked slowly to the door of my building and went inside. Ellen was 60% asleep when I sat down on the bed to take off my shoes. She rolled over and made a fuzzy, interrogative sound deep in her throat. I told her to go back to sleep. She made the muzzy sound again. This time it approximated English. How was it? For a moment I hesitated, my shirt half unbuttoned, and I thought with one moment's utter clarity, if I tell her, I will never see the other side of that door again. It was all right, I said. Old men telling more stories. I told you so. But it wasn't bad. I might go back again. It might do me some good with the firm. The firm. She mocked lightly. What an old buzzard you are, my love. Takes one to know one, I said. But she had already fallen asleep again. I undressed, showered, toweled, put on my pajamas, and then, instead of going to bed as I should have done, it was edging past one by that time, I put on my robe and had another bottle of Beck's. I sat at the kitchen table, drinking it slowly, looking out the window and up the cold canyon of Madison Avenue, thinking, my head was a trifle buzzy from my evening's intake of alcohol. For me, an unexpectedly large intake. But the feeling was not at all unpleasant, and I had no sense of an impending hangover. The thought which had come to me when Ellen asked me about my evening was as ridiculous as the one I'd entertained about George Waterhouse as the cab drew away from me. What in God's name could be wrong with telling my wife about a perfectly harmless evening at my boss's stuffy men's club? And even if something were wrong with telling her, who would know that I had? Oh, it was every bit as ridiculous and paranoid as those earlier musings. And, my heart told me, every bit as true. I met George Waterhouse the next day in the hallway between accounts and the reading library. Met him, passed him would be more accurate. He nodded my way and went on without speaking as he had done for years. My stomach muscles ached all day long. That was the only thing that completely convinced me the evening had been real. 3 weeks passed. 4, 5. No second invitation came from Waterhouse. Somehow I just hadn't been right. Hadn't fit, or so I told myself. It was a depressing, disappointing thought. I supposed it would begin to fade and lose its sting, as all disappointments eventually do, but I thought of that evening at the oddest moments, the isolated pools of library lamplight so still and tranquil and somehow civilized. Waterhouse's absurd and hilarious tale of the schoolteacher stuck in the privy. The rich smell of leather in the narrow stacks. Most of all, I thought of standing by that narrow window and watching the frost crystals change from green to amber to red. I thought of that sense of peace I had felt. During that same 5-week period, I went to the library and checked out 4 volumes of Algernon Williams' poetry. I had 3 others myself and had already checked through them. One of these volumes purported to be The Complete Poems Of. I reacquainted myself with some old favorites, but I found no poem called The Toll in any of the volumes. On that same trip to the New York Public Library, I checked the card catalog for works of fiction by a man named Edward Gray Seville. A mystery novel by a woman named Ruth Seville was the closest I came. Come again if you like. Don't wait for an invitation. I was waiting for an invitation anyway, of course. My mother taught me donkey's years ago not to automatically believe people who tell you glibly to drop by any time or that the door is always open. I didn't feel I needed an engraved card delivered to my apartment door by a footman in livery bearing a gilt plate. I don't mean that, but I did want something, even if it was only a casual remark. Coming by some night, David? Hope we didn't bore you, that kind of thing. But when even that didn't come, I began to think more seriously about going back anyway. After all, sometimes people really did want you to drop in any time. I suppose that at some places the door was always open, and that mothers weren't always right. Don't wait for an invitation. Anyway, that's how it happened that, on December 10th of that year, I found myself putting on my rough tweed coat and dark brown pants again and looking for my darkish red tie. I was rather more aware of my heartbeat than usual that night, I remember. George Waterhouse finally broke down and asked you back, Ellen asked, back into the sty with the rest of the male chauvinist oinkers. That's right, I said, thinking it must be the first time in at least 12 years that I had told her a lie. And then I remembered that after the first meeting I had answered her question about what it had been like with a lie. Old men telling war stories, I had said. Well, maybe there really will be a promotion in it, she said, though, without much hope. To her credit, she said it without much bitterness either. Stranger things have happened, I said, and kissed her goodbye. Oink, oink, she said as I went out the door. The taxi ride that night seemed very long. It was cold, still, and starry. The cab was a checker, and I felt somehow very small in it, like a child seeing the city for the first time. It was excitement I was feeling as the cab pulled up in front of the brownstone, something as simple and yet complete as that. But such simple excitement seems to be one of life's qualities that slip away almost unnoticed, and its rediscovery as one grows older is always something of a surprise, like finding a black hair or two in one's comb years after one has last found such a thing. I paid the driver, got out, and walked toward the 4 steps leading to the door. As I mounted them, my excitement curdled into plain apprehension, a feeling the old are much more familiar with. What exactly were I doing here? The door was of thick paneled oak, and to my eye it looked as stout as the door of a castle keep. There was no doorbell that I could see, no knocker, no closed-circuit TV camera mounted unobtrusively in the shadow of a deep eave, and, of course, no Waterhouse waiting to take me in. I stopped at the foot of the steps and looked around. East 35th Street suddenly seemed darker, colder, more threatening. The brownstones all looked somehow secret, as if hiding mysteries best not investigated. Their windows looked like eyes. Somewhere behind one of those windows there may be a man or woman contemplating murder, I thought. A shudder worked up my spine, contemplating it or doing it. Then suddenly the door was open and Stevens was there. I felt an intense surge of relief. I am not an overly imaginative man, I think, at least not under ordinary circumstances, but this last thought had had all the eerie clarity of prophecy. I might have babbled aloud if I hadn't glanced at Stevens' eyes first. His eyes did not know me. His eyes did not know me at all. Then there was another instance of that eerie, prophetic clarity. I saw the rest of my evening, in perfect detail. 3 hours in a quiet bar, 3 scotches, perhaps 4, to dull the embarrassment of having been fool enough to go where I wasn't wanted. The humiliation my mother's advice had been intended to avoid, that which comes with knowing one has overstepped. I saw myself going home a little tipsy, but not in a good way. I saw myself merely sitting through the cab ride rather than experiencing it through that childlike lens of excitement and anticipation. I heard myself saying to Ellen, "It wears thin." After a while, Waterhouse told the same story about winning a consignment of T-bone steaks for the 3rd Battalion in a poker game, and they play hearts for $1 a point. Can you believe it? Go back? I suppose I might, but I doubt it. And that would be the end of it, except, I suppose, for my own humiliation. I saw all of this in the nothing of Stevens's eyes. Then the eyes warmed. He smiled slightly and said, "Mr. Adley, come in. I'll take your coat." I mounted the steps, and Stevens closed the door firmly behind me. How different a door can feel when you are on the warm side of it. He took my coat and was gone with it. I stood in the hall for a moment, looking at my own reflection in the pier glass, a man of 63 whose face was rapidly becoming too gaunt to look middle-aged. And yet the reflection pleased me. I slipped into the library. Johansson was there, reading his Wall Street Journal. In another island of light, Emlyn McCarran sat over a chessboard opposite Peter Andrews. McCarran was, and is, a cadaverous man, possessed of a narrow, blade-like nose. Andrews was huge, slope-shouldered and choleric. A vast, ginger-colored beard sprayed over his vest. Face to face over the inlaid board with his carved pieces of ivory and ebony, they looked like Indian totems, eagle and bear. Waterhouse was there, frowning over that day's times. He glanced up, nodded at me without surprise, and disappeared into the paper again. Stevens brought me a scotch, unasked. I took it into the stacks and found that puzzling, enticing set of green volumes again. I began reading the works of Edward Gray Seville that night. I started at the beginning with "These Were Our Brothers." Since then, I have read them all, and believe them to be 11 of the finest novels of our century. Near the end of the evening, there was a story, just one, and Stevens brought brandy around. When the tale was told, people began to rise, preparing to leave. Stevens spoke from the double doorway which communicated with the hallway. His voice was low and pleasant, but carrying. "Who will bring us a tale for Christmas, then?" People stopped what they were doing and glanced around. There was some low, good-natured talk and a burst of laughter. Stevens, smiling but serious, clapped his hands together twice, like a grammar school teacher calling an unruly class to order. "Come, gentlemen, who'll bring the tale?" Peter Andrews, he of the sloped shoulders and gingery beard, cleared his throat. "I have something I've been thinking about. I don't know if it's quite right. That is, if it's..." "That will be fine," Stevens interrupted, and there was more laughter. Andrews had his back slapped good-naturedly. Cold drafts swirled up the hallway as men slipped out. Then Stevens was there as if by benign magic, holding my coat for me. "Good evening, Mr. Adley. Always a pleasure." "T. you really meet on Christmas night?" I asked, buttoning my coat. I was a little disappointed that I was going to miss Andrew's story, but we had made firm plans to drive to Schenectady and keep the holiday with Ellen's sister. Stevens managed to look both shocked and amused at the same time. "In no case," he said, "Christmas is a night a man should spend with his family, that night if no other. Don't you agree, sir?" "I certainly do. We always meet on the Thursday before Christmas. In fact, that is the one night of the year when we almost always have a large turnout." He hadn't used the word members, I noticed, just happenstance or neat avoidance. "Many tales have been spun out in the main room, Mr. Adley, tales of every sort, from the comic to the tragic, to the ironic, to the sentimental, but on the Thursday before Christmas it's always a tale of the uncanny. It's always been that way, at least as far back as I can remember." That at least explained the comment I had heard on my first visit, the one to the effect that Norman Stetch should have saved his story for Christmas. Other questions hovered on my lips, but I saw a reflected caution in Stephen's eyes. It was not a warning that he would not answer my questions. It was rather a warning that I should not even ask them. "Was there something else, Mr. Hadley?" We were alone in the hall now. All the others had left. And suddenly the hallway seemed darker, Stephen's long face paler, his lips redder. A nut exploded in the fireplace, and a red glow washed momentarily across the polished parquet floor. I thought I heard from somewhere in those as-yet unexplored rooms beyond a kind of slithery bump. I did not like the sound, not at all. "No," I said in a voice that was not quite steady. "I think not." "Good night, then," Stephen said, and I crossed the threshold. I heard the heavy door close behind me. I heard the lock turn, and then I was walking toward the lights of Third Avenue, not looking back over my shoulder, somehow afraid to look back, as if I might see some frightful fiend matching me stride for stride, or glimpse some secret better kept than known. I reached the corner, saw an empty cab, and flagged it. "More war stories?" Ellen asked me that night. She was in bed with Philip Marlowe, the only lover she has ever taken. "There was a war story or two," I said, hanging up my overcoat. "Mostly I sat and read a book."
"When you weren't oinking."
"Yes, that's right, when I wasn't oinking."
"Listen to this. The first time I laid eyes on Terry Lennox, he was drunk in a Rolls-Royce silver wraith outside the terrace of the Dancers," Ellen read. "He had a young-looking face, but his hair was bone-white. You could tell by his eyes that he was plastered to the hairline, but otherwise he looked like any other nice young guy in a dinner jacket who had been spending too much money in a joint that exists for that purpose and for no other."
"Nice, huh? It's The Long Goodbye," I said, taking off my shoes.
"You read me that same passage once every 3 years. It's part of your life cycle."
She wrinkled her nose at me. "Oink, oink."
"Thank you," I said.
She went back to her book. I went out into the kitchen to get a bottle of Beck's. When I came back, she had laid The Long Goodbye open on the counterpane and was looking at me closely.
"David, are you going to join this club?"
"I suppose I might, if I'm asked." I felt uncomfortable. I had perhaps told her another lie. If there was such a thing as membership at 249B East 35th, I already was a member.
"I'm glad," she said. "You've needed something for a long time now. I don't think you even know it, but you have. I've got the Relief Committee and the Commission on Women's Rights and the Theater Society, but you've needed something, some people to grow old with, I think."
I went to the bed and sat beside her and picked up The Long Goodbye. It was a bright, new minted paperback. I could remember buying the original hardback edition as a birthday present for Ellen in 1953.
"Are we old?" I asked her.
"I suspect we are," she said, and smiled brilliantly at me.
I put the book down and touched her breast. Too old for this? She turned the covers back with ladylike decorum, and then, giggling, kicked them onto the floor with her feet. Beat me, Daddy, Ellen said. 8 to the bar. Oink, oink, I said, and then we were both laughing. The Thursday before Christmas came. That evening was much the same as the others, with 2 notable exceptions. There were more people there, perhaps as many as 18, and there was a sharp, indefinable sense of excitement in the air. Johansson took only a cursory glance at his journal and then joined McCarran, Hugh Beagleman, and myself. We sat near the windows, talking of this and that, then finally fell into a passionate and often hilarious discussion of pre-war automobiles. There was, now that I think of it, a 3rd difference as well. Stevens had concocted a delicious eggnog punch. It was smooth, but it was also hot with rum and spices. It was served from an incredible Waterford bowl that looked like an ice sculpture, and the animated hum of the conversation grew ever higher as the level of the punch grew lower. I looked over in the corner by the tiny door leading to the billiard room and was astounded to see Waterhouse and Norman Stett flipping baseball cards into what looked like a genuine beaver top hat. They were laughing uproariously. Groups formed and reformed. The hour grew late. And then, at the time when people usually began slipping out through the front door, I saw Peter Andrews seated in front of the fire with an unmarked packet, about the size of a seed envelope, in one hand. He tossed it into the flames without opening it, and a moment later the fire began to dance with every color of the spectrum, and some I would have sworn from outside of it before turning yellow again. Chairs were dragged around. Over Andrew's shoulder I could see the keystone with its etched homily. It is the tale, not he who tells it. Stevens passed unobtrusively among us, taking punch glasses and replacing them with snifters of brandy. There were murmurs of Merry Christmas and Top of the Season, Stevens, and for the first time I saw money change hands. A $10 bill was unobtrusively tendered here, a bill that looked like a 50 there, one which I clearly saw was 100 from another chair. Thank you, Mr. McCarran. Mr. Johansson, Mr. Beagleman, a quiet, well-bred murmur. I have lived in New York long enough to know that the Christmas season is a carnival of tips, something for the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, not to mention the doorman, the super, and the cleaning lady who comes in Tuesdays and Fridays. I've never met anyone of my own class who regarded this as anything but a necessary nuisance. But I felt none of that grudging spirit on that night. The money was given willingly, even eagerly, and suddenly, for no reason. It was the way thoughts often seemed to come when one was at 249B. I thought of the boy calling up to Scrooge on the still cold air of a London Christmas morning. What? The goose that's as big as me? And Scrooge, nearly crazed with joy, giggling, a good boy, an excellent boy. I found my own wallet. In the back of this, behind the pictures of Ellen I keep, there has always been a $50 bill which I keep for emergencies. When Stevens gave me my brandy, I slipped it into his hand with never a qualm, although I was not a rich man. Happy Christmas, Stevens, I said. Thank you, sir, and the same to you. He finished passing out the brandies and collecting his honorariums and retired. I glanced around once at the midpoint of Peter Andrews' story and saw him standing by the double doors, a dim, man-like shadow, stiff and silent. I'm a lawyer now, as most of you know, Andrew said, after sipping at his glass, clearing his throat, and then sipping again. I've had offices on Park Avenue for the last 22 years, but before that I was a legal assistant in a firm of lawyers which did business in Washington, D.C. One night in July, I was required to stay late in order to finish indexing case citations in a brief which hasn't anything at all to do with this story. But then a man came in, a man who was at that time one of the most widely known senators on the Hill, a man who later almost became president. His shirt was matted with blood, and his eyes were bulging from their sockets. I've got to talk to Joe, he said. Joe, you understand, was Joseph Woods, the head of my firm, one of the most influential private sector lawyers in Washington, and this senator's close personal friend. He went home hours ago, I said. I was terribly frightened, I can tell you. He looked like a man who had just walked away from a dreadful car accident, or perhaps from a knife fight. And somehow seeing his face, which I had seen in newspaper photos and on Meet the Press, seeing it streaked with gore, one cheek twitching spasmodically below one wild eye, all of that made my fright worse. I can call him if you... I was already fumbling with the phone, mad with eagerness to turn this unexpected responsibility over to someone else. Looking behind him, I could see the caked and bloody footprints he had left on the carpet. I've got to talk to Joe right now, he reiterated as if he hadn't heard me. There's something in the trunk of my car, something I found out at the Virginia place. I've shot it and stabbed it, and I can't kill it. It's not human, and I can't kill it. He began to giggle, and then to laugh, and finally to scream, and he was still screaming when I finally got Mr. Woods on the phone and told him to come, for God's sake, to come as fast as he could. It is not my purpose to tell Peter Andrews' story, either. As a matter of fact, I'm not sure I would dare to tell it. Suffice it to say that it was a tale so gruesome that I dreamed of it for weeks afterward, and Ellen once looked at me over the breakfast table and asked me why I had suddenly cried out, his head is still speaking in the earth, in the middle of the night. I suppose it was a dream, I said, one of those you can't remember afterwards. But my eyes dropped immediately to my coffee cup, and I think that Ellen knew the lie that time. One day in August of the following year, I was buzzed as I worked in the reading library. It was George Waterhouse. He asked me if I could step up to his office. When I got there, I saw that Robert Carden was also there and Henry Effingham. For one moment, I was positive I was about to be accused of some really dreadful act of stupidity or ineptitude. Then Carden stepped around to me and said, George believes the time has come to make you a junior partner, David. The rest of us agree. It's going to be a little bit like being the world's oldest J.C., Effingham said with a grin. But it's the channel you have to go through, David. With any luck, we can make you a full partner by Christmas. There were no bad dreams that night. Ellen and I went out to dinner, drank too much, went on to a jazz place where we hadn't been in nearly 6 years, and listened to that amazing blue-eyed black man Dexter Gordon blow his horn until almost 2 in the morning. We woke up the next morning with fluttery stomachs and achy heads, both of us still unable to completely believe what had happened. One of them was that my salary had just climbed by $8,000 a year, long after our expectations of such a staggering income jump had fallen by the wayside. The firm sent me to Copenhagen for 6 weeks that fall, and I returned to discover that John Hanrahan, one of the regular attendees at 249B, had died of cancer. A collection was taken up for his wife, who had been left in unpleasant circumstances. I was pressed into service to total the amount, which was given entirely in cash, and converted to a cashier's check. It came to more than $10,000. I turned the check over to Stevens, and I suppose he mailed it. It just so happened that Arlene Hanrahan was a member of Ellen's Theater Society, and Ellen told me sometime later that Arlene had received an anonymous check for $10,400. Written on the check stub was the brief and unilluminating message, "Friends of your late husband John." Isn't that the most amazing thing you ever heard in your life? Ellen asked me. No, I said, but it's right up there in the top 10. Are there any more strawberries, Ellen? The years went by. I discovered a warren of rooms upstairs at 249B, a writing room, a bedroom where guests sometimes stayed overnight, although after that slithery bump I had heard or imagined I had heard, I believe I personally would rather have registered at a good hotel, a small but well-equipped gymnasium and a sauna bath. There was also a long, narrow room which ran the length of the building and contained 2 bowling alleys. In those same years, I re-read the novels of Edward Gray Saville. and discovered an absolutely stunning poet, the equal of Ezra Pound and Wallace Stevens, perhaps, named Norbert Rosen. According to the back flap on one of the three volumes of his work in the stacks, he had been born in 1924 and killed at Anzio. All three volumes of his work had been published by Stedham and Son, New York and Boston. I remember going back to the New York Public Library on a bright spring afternoon during one of those years, of which year I am no longer sure, and requesting 20 years' worth of Literary Marketplace. The LMP is an annual publication the size of a large city's yellow pages, and the reference room librarian was quite put out with me, I'm afraid, but I persisted and went through each volume carefully. And although LMP is supposed to list every publisher, great and small, in the United States, in addition to agents, editors, and book club staffs, I found no listing for Stedham and Son. A year later, or perhaps it was 2 years later, I fell into conversation with an antiquarian book dealer and asked him about the imprint. He said he had never heard of it. I thought of asking Stevens, saw that warning light in his eyes, and dropped the question unasked. And over those years there were stories, tales, to use Stephen's word, funny tales, tales of love found and love lost, tales of unease, yes, and even a few war stories, although none of the sort Ellen had likely been thinking of when she made the suggestion. I remember Gerard Toseman's story the most clearly, the tale of an American base of operations which took a direct hit from German artillery 4 months before the end of World War I, killing everyone present except for Toseman himself. Lathrop Carruthers, the American general who everyone had by then decided must be utterly insane, he had been responsible for better than 18,000 casualties by then, lives and limbs spent as casually as you or I might spend a quarter in a jukebox, was standing at a map of the front lines when the shell struck. He had been explaining yet another mad flanking operation at the moment, an operation which would have succeeded only on the level of all the others Carruthers had hatched. It would be wonderfully successful at making new widows. And when the dust cleared, Gerard Toseman, dazed and deaf, bleeding from his nose, his ears, and the corners of both eyes, his testicles already swelling from the force of the concussion, had come upon Carruthers' body while looking for a way out of the abattoir that had been the staff HQ only minutes before. He looked at the general's body and then began to scream and laugh. The sounds went unheard by his own shell-shocked ears, but they served to notify the medicos that someone was still alive in that strew of matchwood. Carruthers had not been mutilated by the blast, at least Toseman said. It hadn't been what the soldiers of that long-ago war had come to think of as mutilation. Men whose arms had been blown off, men with no feet, no eyes, men whose lungs had been shriveled by gas. No, he said, it was nothing like that. The man's mother would have known him at once. But the map... before which Carruthers had been standing with his butcher's pointer when the shell struck, it had somehow been driven into his face. Toseman had found himself staring into a hideous, tattooed death mask. Here was the stony shore of Brittany on the bony ridge of Lathrop Carruthers' brow. Here was the Rhine flowing like a blue scar down his left cheek. Here were some of the finest wine-growing provinces in the world bumped and ridged over his chin. Here was the Tsar drawn around his throat like a hangman's noose, and printed across one bulging eyeball was the word Versailles. That was our Christmas story in the year 1970-something. I remember many others, but they do not belong here. Properly speaking, Toseman's doesn't either, but it was the first Christmas tale I heard at 249B, and I could not resist telling it. And then, on the Thursday after Thanksgiving of this year, when Stevens clapped his hands together for attention and asked who would favor us with a Christmas tale, Emlyn McCarron growled, I suppose I've got something that bears telling. Tell it now or tell it never, God'll shut me up for good soon enough. In the years I had been coming to 249B, I had never heard McCarran tell a story, and perhaps that's why I called the taxi so early, and why, when Stevens passed out eggnog to the six of us who had ventured out on that bellowing, frigid night, I felt so keenly excited. Nor was I the only one. I saw that same excitement on a good many other faces. McCarran, old and dry and leathery, sat in the huge chair by the fire with the packet of powder in his gnarled hands. He tossed it in, and we watched the flame shift colors madly before returning to yellow again. Stevens passed among us with brandy, and we passed him his Christmas honorarium. Once, during that yearly ceremony, I had heard the clink of change passing from the hand of the giver to the hand of the receiver. On another occasion, I had seen a $1,000 bill for a moment in the firelight. On both occasions, the murmur of Stevens's voice had been exactly the same, low, considerate, and entirely correct. 10 years, more or less, had passed since I had first come to 249B with George Waterhouse, and while much had changed in the world outside, nothing had changed in here, and Stevens seemed not to have aged a month or even a single day. He moved back into the shadows, and for a moment there was a silence so perfect that we could hear the faint whistle of boiling sap escaping from the burning logs on the hearth. Emlyn McCarran was looking into the fire, and we all followed his gaze. The flames seemed particularly wild that night. I felt almost hypnotized by the sight of the fire, as I suppose the cavemen who birthed us were once hypnotized by it, as the wind walked and talked outside their cold northern caves. At last, still looking into the fire, bent slightly forward so that his forearms rested on his thighs and his clasped hands hung in a knot between his knees, McCarran began to speak.